You can medicate crazy. You can educate ignorance. But there ain't no fixing stupid. And Keynesian economics is stupid because it's all partial equilibrium and can't work. If you think you can spend money that doesn't come from someone else as a government, you're crazy. They get the wrong economics and they get locked into it. They never can change their minds.
Than just a regular gym routine. When was the last time you checked on your financial fitness? If you're feeling like you're falling behind, Ed Sedell is here to help with The Retirement Trainer, a podcast about helping you get into better financial shape. Every week, Ed talks about things you need to know to become more financially fit for your future. Learn about things like how much money will you need, financial mistakes other people often make, and how you can avoid them. Plus, details on The Retirement Fitness Plan, a plan Ed personally created to help you get to and through retirement by focusing on five key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan when you visit egsifinancial.com and click on processes. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
Well, today we have a very special guest. We have Dr. Arthur Laffer, who is probably best known and came to prominence during the Reagan administration as part of his economic council and supply side economics. Also very well known in what I learned in college, the Laffer curve in economics class, and his accolades go on and on and on. But his book, Taxes Have Consequences. So this is not a light read, but it's a very easy read. I think everyone should read this. Just the way that you put the historical facts in order. And honestly, the questions that I have, the conversation, I'd really like to kind of go along that path, if that's all right with you.
I'd love it.
And like we were talking about before we started recording, our listeners, they're experts in their respective field, but they're not economists. So I just kind of like to build a little bit of foundation on Keynesianism versus supply side, the difference in the good, the bad, and the ugly, if that's all right.
I would love it, love it, love it. You know, just to make sure you have it there, I have two co-authors with that book called Dr. Brian Dmitrovic, who's a very famous, well-known historian, and Dr. Jean Sinkfield. And she's just a phenomenal data person. She's amazing. So those are my two co-authors, and I want to never omit their names from the thing. You know, this is something I've been working on for 40 years and brought them in. And by God, they made this book much better because of them. So let me just give you my background for a second, if I can. And undergraduate, Yale University. I then went to Stanford Business School. I graduated from the business school. I then transferred departments. I got my PhD in economics. I then got the most coveted job offer from the University of Chicago for economics. That's the place to be. I was at Brookings Institution. I then, after Chicago, went and became the Charles B. Thornton Professor at USC. I was George Shultz's right-hand person from 1970 to 1972 in the Nixon White House. I was the chief economist there, at least with George Shultz at that time, so at the tender age of 30 years old. So how's that? Wow. First American to go to China in 1970, October of 1970. I went with George Shultz and John Ehrlichman, and I just stepped into China, but pulled myself back. But I was in charge of the domestic economy of China for the White House as a staffer now, not as the big boom, 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 but as a little beep. I was there, and same thing with Vietnam. So, you know, then, of course, you know my history with Reagan. I never did take a job ever again after the Nixon White House ever again officially, because once you get a paycheck, you're an employee, you don't get to say what you really think is right. And I've been involved with Trump, and I've been involved with Dick Cheney, who was my classmate. I could go on, but I've been going to the Oval Office now for 54 years with presidents. I've been through all of that stuff. I've worked on a lot of states. You may know Prop 13 in California. Probably I've been involved in 15, 20 state stuff. And Margaret Thatcher, I did a lot there. I was probably the only staff American over there with her. And Chile, down there in the 70s with the Chicago boys. I was a Chicago boy, Argentina. So I do revolutions, and I love, love, love doing revolutions. And no group warrants my enthusiasm more than lefties and socialists and Fabians, et cetera. And the reason is that I'm an economist, and I want to go through economics is all about incentives. Strictly speaking, it's just incentives. You know, people don't work to pay taxes. people work to get what they can after tax. It's that after tax return that incentivizes a person to get educated so they can earn higher wages, to shift from one job to another job, to move from one state to another state. All of these things are based on incentives. That's the key one there. Now, to a Keynesian, people work because there are jobs. But to a supply side economist, people work because they get paid after tax. Very major distinction. The second distinction is to a Keynesian, people save because their incomes are high. There's a saving rate on your income. So when your income goes up, you save more. When your income goes down, you save less. This is critical to the Keynesian model. It is. To supply-siders, that's not the case. People save to make an after-tax return on their savings, not because their incomes are high. And people won't save when they're guaranteed losses on their savings. So you see the two differences. And it's really all incentive-based differences. And the last one that I'm going to highlight with you here, to a Keynesian, if you raise tax rates by 10%, you're going to collect 10% more revenues. And that's what it is. The world is static with regard to income. And the only decision a government makes is how much of total income do they take. And if they take 10%, that's one thing. If they take 20%, it's twice as much as 10%. To us, that's not the way it works. People don't supply a fixed amount of income. What they do is they respond to tax rates. And tax rates change the after-tax relationship between income and leisure because of taxes. And when you raise tax rates, people will work less than they otherwise would have worked. When you lower tax rates, they'll work more than they otherwise would have worked. The incentives are greater. And when you look at that in terms of tax revenues, you can see that it's a very different picture than a Keynesian, because at 100% taxes, and I'm going to the extreme here to make
right,
a point.
Right, absolutely.
A pedagogic device I'm doing with you here. At 100% taxes, where no matter how much you worked, no matter how much you made, you got to keep nothing. People would find no incentive to work, and they wouldn't work, and there'd be no revenue. You with me?
Yeah.
If you don't believe that, let's make it 120%. So every time.
Wasn't Ronald Reagan's famous thing, you know, if the IRS had their way, there'd be two lines. How much do you make? And the second line is send it in, right?
And that was Teddy Kennedy's flat tax on the day.
That's right.
But, you know, if you pay 120% tax, so every time you go to the office, instead of getting a check, you get a bill. How much money? You know, that's to make it extreme. So at 100% tax rates, there'll be zero revenues because no one will work. And at 0% taxes, obviously, people work like mad and earn a lot, but there'll be no taxes because the government doesn't tax.
Mm-hmm.
So now what you see happening is from 0% tax rates, if you raise those tax rates ever so slightly, you can see how revenues will go up. Even though some people may stop working, there'll be enough people working that you will collect. And you can see how you're rising. The higher you raise those tax rates, the more disincentives there are. So the increase in tax revenues declines. All right. And the same thing with when you drop tax rates from 100% to 99 to 98 to 97, sooner or later, some dummy will go to work, earn some income, and they'll tax, and revenues will increase going down. And those two points will meet in a curve. Again, remember, this is just a pedagogic device. This is not meant to be a description, an empirical description of the world. There are two effects taxes have on revenues. One is the tax rate effect, which is if you raise tax rates, you'll collect more revenue per dollar of tax base. That's the one effect. Mm-hmm. Then you have the other effect, which is on the tax base itself. If you raise tax rates, you reduce people's incentives to produce, and it'll shrink the tax base. These two effects always work in the opposite direction. All right? When you raise rates, you lower the base. When you lower rates, you increase the base. And that's where you get the Laffer curve. And that becomes pretty obvious. Now, there are all sorts of complications to the curve. Just to make sure you don't think it was something I did on a Saturday night after a bottle of wine, how long, what you tax, the lower the tax base, the more likely it is that taxes in the prohibitive range. The longer you're willing to wait, the more likely it is in the prohibitive range, the smaller the company, all sorts of things in there that affect this. But intuitively, there are two tax rates for every revenue, a high one and a low one. That's all you need to keep in mind there. You follow me in that?
Absolutely.
And you ask me why I think Keynesianism doesn't work is because Keynesianism is not based on personal incentives. So therefore, it's really not economics. It's a sociological, whatever it is. when your income goes up, your savings goes up. And if your savings goes up, the return on capital goes down and you get maybe a recession or whatever it is. And then you get investments and animal spirits and all that. No, no, no. Let me talk to you in that the government can increase demand by spending more. Now, that's a classic of a Keynesian. If you spend, let's say, $60, the person who receives, the government does, the person who receives that $60, they'll spend a portion of that, of their income there. That's the marginal propensity to consume. That in turn will create jobs, output, and employment. That's what they say. And those people will have higher incomes and they'll spend some of that. And there'll be this cascading effect through the system. To be a little bit geeky with you on the Keynesian model, you know, this is a 1/multiplier, the $60 that you spent. The multiplier, and that is 1/(1 - the marginal propensity to consume is what they say, and that's the multiplier, and right. That's how much total income will go up. And every Keynesian will agree that that's it. But what they miss, Ed, and what they miss desperately is that government doesn't create resources. Government redistributes resources. That's what I wanted to get on the transfer theorem, and I'll come to that transfer theorem with you in a second. But if you take from someone else the $60 and you give it to someone else, it's true that the person you give the money to will be better off and they'll spend more and all of that will happen. But the person from whom you take the $60, won't they spend less? Won't that in turn get them to spend less? These two effects offset each other 100% by the hour, by the day, by the week, by the minute, by the year, to the 9,365th decimal place. What isn't eliminated here on the Keynesian model, which is just purely an income effect of government spending, is the substitution effect. Imagine if we had the government spend 100% of all GDP. So everyone who worked and produced received nothing, and all those who didn't work and didn't produce received everything. What do you think would happen to GDP? It would go to zero.
Zero.
It'd go zero right away. And this is the transfer theorem. And let me go through this with you because it's very important you understand this, because this is what economics is all about, not sociology, which is Keynesian economics. Whenever you take from one group and give to another group, that's called a transfer. Mm-hmm. Okay, the government goes to tall people, takes their money, gives it to short people, which I sort of like being a little short myself.
Me too. I like it.
I love it, love it, love it. You can take from old people and give to young people, which I don't like, but you can take from young people and give to old people. I'm really into that. You can take it from, you know, fat ones to skinny ones and all that. Normally, when we talk about a transfer, we usually think about it in increasing a transfer payment taken from those who have a little bit more to give to those who have a little bit less. This is called redistribution, but it is purely redistribution. It's just the description of a transfer. That's all it is. So what I'm going to talk here about, I'm going to use this example, the redistribution example, as my example of a transfer payment, so that you can see the principles of economics operating.
Great.
Which is, if you take from those who have a little bit more, and you give to those who have a little bit less, that is the redistribution transfer payment. With me?
Yep.
Now, by taking from those who have a little bit more, you reduce their incentives to produce, and they will produce a little bit less. Make sense?
Absolutely.
That's incentive.
That makes incentive.
They'll produce a little bit less. Now, when you give to those who have a little bit less, you provide them with an alternative source of income other than working, and they too will produce a little bit less. In other words, you reduce the incentives on both parts. You reduce the incentive for the top ones to work, and then they'll produce less. You reduce the incentives to work on the bottom ones, and they will produce. The theorem here, and it's not left wing, it's not right wing, it's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's not Republican or Democrat. It's just math. Whenever you redistribute income, you always will reduce total income. Always. That's math. And I don't give a damn who you are. That's what actually happens. It's math. It's a theorem. Now, that's neat. And I just proved it to you verbally to you, by the way. The math is real easy, too.
Right.
But let me then give you now the lemma from this theorem. The lemma from this theorem is delicious. And the lemma I'm not going to prove for you, but I think it'll be self-explanatory. The lemma is, the more you redistribute, the greater will be the reduction in total income. That should be pretty obvious. All right. I'm not going to prove that one. But now the limit function of this theorem has this piquant flavor that is so wonderful. And I wish you had one of your clients, one of your viewers, one of your hits, where Nancy Pelosi or Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or maybe AOC or some of the others, or any Republican, by the way. They're all equally as ignorant on this stuff as anyone. But those people are ignorant publicly,
which makes
it much better. If you were able to redistribute all income, now this is the limit function. If you were able to redistribute all income such that everyone came out exactly the same after the fact, there will be no income whatsoever. Let me describe this to you mathematically again. In order to get everyone to come out exactly the same, what you have to do is you have to tax everyone who earns above the average income 100% of the excess. And what you have to do is subsidize everyone below the average income up to the average income. That is the only way you can assure that everyone will have exactly the same after the redistribution policies. You with me?
Absolutely.
Now, if you actually did that, Ed, if you actually taxed everyone above the average income 100% of the excess, and if you actually subsidize everyone below the average income up to the average income, I will stipulate today, counselor, we'll all come out equal at zero. There will be no income whatsoever. Now, that's the math. That's the theorem. And it's true no matter who you are in any planet, any city, any country, any economic system on earth, this will be the response, period. It's human incentives. Now, I try to explain this to my students. They have a hard time understanding this because they've never worked. So they go, what's this tax? Who's FICA? I don't know who this FICA guy is, you know. So I tried to make the example in terms of my students. Mm-hmm. So what I did with my students is I tried to explain it to them this way. I said, if I ran this class the way your government runs your country, what I would do is I'd flunk all the A students out and give all the F students scholarships. I'd redistribute all the bump. You with me?
Yep, absolutely.
Now, if you think about it for a second, and don't giggle at this, but if you think about it for a second, my A students happen to be a little bit smarter and a little bit more adept at economics than my F students. So once I change the rules, all right, my A students are able to get lower grades than my F students because they never randomly make the mistake of guessing a correct answer. And my F students sometimes guess a correct answer. What happens is my A students still get all the scholarships because they can get the lowest grades because they never make a mistake. My F students still get flunked out. They have the highest grades because they don't understand when they've made a mistake. I have not changed the redistribution of grades one iota. But what have I done, Ed? What I have done is I've destroyed the entire quality of the educational process. Mm-hmm. Let me extend that logic over to economics if I can. You cannot change the distribution of income by redistributionist policies. But what you can do is change the volume of income. Every revolution on planet Earth has always been dedicated to changing the distribution of income. And not one has ever succeeded whatsoever. But what they all have succeeded in doing is destroying the volume of income. Are you with me? And do you follow what I mean? This is why Keynesianism doesn't work. Yep. And it's not because they're bad people. They're just ignorant. And, you know, if I can say this to my friends in the academic colleague, and I went to all the PhD programs with all of them. I got better grades than they did, mind you, and I got better promotions than they did. But you can medicate crazy. You can educate ignorance. But there ain't no fixing stupid. And Keynesian economics is stupid because it's all partial equilibrium and can't work. If you think you can spend money that doesn't come from someone else as a government, you're crazy. We can medicate that one. And if you think you can do it, well, you can see what I'm saying here. And this is why Keynesianism doesn't work. Now, what happens is if you train them all in the PhD programs and the undergraduates, clearly it's all Keynesianism, and no one's taught classical economics or supply-side economics. These people, impressing their professors, they get the wrong economics and they get locked into it. They never can change their minds. You will never take a professor and teach that professor supply-side economics because they ain't willing to listen. They just aren't. Now, I've gone through the Laffer curve with you. I've gone through what Keynesian and supply-side economics are with you. I've done the transfer theorem with you. I've discussed why I don't think Keynesian economics works with you. Now we want to talk about the world.
Yes.
The data. What you find on the data is those countries that raise tax rates grow slower than those countries that lower tax rates. It's empirical. I can easily understand. I can make the case that the government would do better if it raised tax rates and spent it. I could make that logical argument. I can make the argument in the opposite. It's about facts, Ed. It's about facts. And, you know, this isn't about how you feel. It's not, I don't give a damn what your opinion is. Now it's about facts, not how you feel. All right. Tell me, what are the fastest growing states in the nation?
How about Florida?
How about Texas? How about Tennessee? How about Nevada? How about South Dakota? How about New Hampshire? But I'll do them all. They're all zero income tax states. What are the slowest growing states in the nation? Yeah, they're the New Yorks, the Connecticuts, the Illinois. They're the They're the New Jerseys. I could go on and they're all states that have introduced an income tax in the last since 1960. You know, if you look at this just educationally, you find a very direct link between raising taxes, putting in income taxes in states, and their relative performance. Which states are having people move into them and which states are having people move out of them? The same thing. And I could go on and on with you on this stuff. Which countries are doing the best? Which countries are doing the worst? When did the U.S. do well? It did really well under John F. Kennedy when we cut the highest marginal income tax rate from 91% to 70%. We cut the lowest rate from 20% to 14%. It did really well under Bill Clinton when you cut tax rates on capital gains and massively cut it. When you cut government spending as a share of GDP by a lot under Clinton. When Reagan was president, it worked beautifully when we got the highest tax rate from 70% to 28% at the federal level. It worked. We cut the capital gains tax rate. I'm just the corporate rate. We cut it from 70% to 28% under Reagan. Is that a good enough cut for you? Okay, we cut the corporate tax from 46% to 34%. Is that a good enough cut in the corporate rate? We went from 11 tax brackets to 2 tax brackets, a 28% bracket and a 15% bracket. We got rid of all these brackets and had almost a flat tax. You know, what happened under Reagan? What happened under Kennedy? It was called the go-go 60s, the Reagan boom. It was called the roaring 20s. You know, I'm giving you anecdotes here because it's really hard to go through all that. Now I want to talk to you one more time about the RIT. And this is the redistributionist model. And this is the Bernie Sanders, the Elizabeth Warren model. And there are all these economists. They call themselves economists from MIT, from Harvard, from the University of California, Berkeley. You know them. It's Piketty and Emmanuel Saez and Sancheva. You've got Zuckman. You've got blah, blah, blah. There are a whole group of these people of income inequality. And then what they do is they want to raise tax rates on the rich. All right. And for the benefit of the poor. And they make the arguments here. And the arguments are possible. I mean, they comport with intuition to people who aren't economists. If you raise tax rates on the rich, you're going to get more revenues and you'll be able to use those monies to support the poor and you will reduce income distribution. And even though there will be disincentives for the rich, the economy will do well because you broaden the tax base. Does it sound like a president, you know, we're going to build the economy from building it out and the rich have to pay their fair share? This is the whole model of raising tax rates on the rich. And you hear it all the time. You with me? If you raise tax rates on the rich, it won't affect growth very much. If it does, you're going to make the poor better off.
Yeah. Okay.
We have the facts in that book that you just showed. We have every single tax return in the United States from 1913 to the present. Every one. It's not sampling. We know exactly the tax return that is the last one in the top 1%. And we have the last tax return, which is the first one in the bottom 99%. We have all their deductions, exemptions, exclusions, everything they did. We know it. We also have all the legislation that Congress put through at the federal level. And now, as you know, the income tax was put into place in 1913. All right, we passed the 16th Amendment. And 9 months later, we had our first income tax, progressive income tax. It was a widow bitty one. Ed, no. If you give me a few minutes on this, I'll go through it with you.
Absolutely.
It's really important. In 1913, the highest marginal income tax rate was 7%, and the lowest rate was 1%. It went up there progressively the more you made. Now, just for the record, the total number of people required to file an income tax in 1913 was 358,000 people. Now, there were 62 million adults at that time. A large portion of them, let's say 60, 70%, worked and had income. So it was a very, very, very teeny tiny group who were required to even file an income tax, less than 0.5% of the population. All right. The tax rates went up to 7% in that little teeny tiny group. In 1913, they only included income for the last 2 months of the year after the bill was passed. So it was even littler than that. Okay. So a little tiny thing. 1913, 14, and 15 were all the exact same years, no change in the tax codes. Only now in 14 and 15, they had a full year's income there, but it was still a little tiny bit. Then all of a sudden, bang, government found out this was a good source of income. They liked it. 16, 17, and 18, the income tax rate rose from 7%. In 1918, they'd raised it to 77%. Now, let me get you that on that. It went from 7% to 77%. All right. And the number of people required to file taxes went from 358,000 to 6.5 million. So they did two things. They expanded the coverage of the tax to a lot larger segment of the adult population, and they raised the highest rate to 77%. Now, they did it with the best of excuses. We have a war, World War I. We have a pandemic. You remember the pandemic of, maybe not personally, but it was a big deal. It was like COVID-19, and it was big. So they had all this need for government funding. And then, of course, after that war, after that pandemic was over, there was a big election in 1920, which was with Woodrow Wilson's handpicked candidate, which is a guy from Ohio. The governor of Ohio was the handpicked candidate there. And his running mate was his best friend, a guy named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That was the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. And they stood for keeping tax rates high to pay off the debt from the war. And it was Harding and Coolidge were the Republican candidates, all right, who wanted to return to normalcy to cut tax rate. The Republicans won by the largest percentage ever. Boom. Now I'm going to start short circuiting. You can see how detailed we've gone through in these books. Each period is covered in obnoxious detail. All right, fun detail. They dropped the highest tax rate from 77% down to 25%. Is that a good enough cut for you? They did it over progressive periods there. The period they did that over, it became the Roaring Twenties. Output, employment, and production. Tax revenue soared. Tax revenue shrank in 2018. The tax revenue soared during the Roaring Twenties. It was one of the biggest booms of all time. After World War I, when they kept the rates high, the economy tanked. It was a terrible time, a horrible recession after World War I. Then you've got 1929, where you had the Smoot-Hawley tariff came in, crashed the economy. Then you had what you had under Herbert Hoover. He raised the highest tax rate from 25% to 63%. He shrunk the brackets way down. So you hit the 63% at a much lower income than before. Comprehensive taxes there. Boom. Roosevelt won the election in 1932. He came in. He put a wealth tax on by confiscating all the gold. And then you had the tax rate was raised in 1937. It was raised. In 1937, it was raised from 63% to from 63% to 74%. Then it went all the way up to 1944. It went up to 94%, the high. We have huge volatility in the highest tax rates on the top 1% of income earners. We have every single tax return. We have all of the facts before us. Now, tell me how many of your liberal economists who study taxes and claim to be economists, how many of them literally ever tell you, every single time we've raised the highest tax rate, three things have happened. The economy is underperformed. All right. Tax revenues from the rich have gone down and the poor have gotten hammered. I mean, hammered. The Great Depression was not a good time for the poor. World War II was not a good time for the poor, just in case you're asking. World War I was not a good time for the poor. The three things happen when you raise the tax rates is, number one, the economy underperforms. Tax revenues from the rich go down and the poor get hammered. Now, three things happen when you lower tax rates. Shock, oh, shock. Every time when you lower tax rates, the economy outperforms. The go-go 60s, the roaring 20s, you name the period, the Reagan period. When you lower the taxes on the top 1% of income earners, the economy outperforms. Tax revenues from the rich go up, not down, because they stop sheltering their income and they start paying their taxes fair and square. All right. And the poor get jobs and they earn income and they get employment and they do much, much better. That is the truth. And that is the whole truth and nothing but the truth from the standpoint of taxes. Now, if you want to get Saez on this show with you, I'd be more than happy to, or Zenshev or Zuckman or any of these other people. I use their data. I mean, they are very, very good at assembling and doing all the tax data. They did a great job, but they just don't report what I just told you. Now, why don't they report it with their data is anyone's guess, but you never hear. And they refuse to debate me, Ed, for obvious reasons, because I use their data and they're wrong. And they lie. They are motivated by politics, unfortunately, rather than science. They rebut arguments they know to be true, Ed, in order to curry favors with their political benefactors. They put a thumb on the scale of their own data. And that's why they won't debate me in public. Now, I have had four or five debates in public, but not with these people who do it. And every single time you can watch those debates and every single time you can see the guys concede my point. I mean, rich know how to, the rich are rich.
Well, it's about the math. You can't argue with that.
Yeah, and we can't argue with the facts, but also the logic. I mean, rich people like to earn income too. So when you tax rates, they do all they can to get around it. They can change the location of their income. They can move from California to Tennessee like I did, or they can change the composition of their income. They can go from earned income to capital gains or to other favored income sources. They can change the timing of their income. They can use, change the timing of their income as they did in the 50s all the time. So their income gets treated a better thing with their savings accounts and their retirement funds and they could change the volume of their income. They can go and take a trip around the world in a sailboat and not be suffering that much. They can live off their wealth there. They can do this. And in the book, in chapter 2, we go through the 20 best tax shelters of the whole century plus period of the income. You'll love them. They're just great examples of this. So that's what they can. Not only can they change the location of their income, the timing of their income, the composition of their income, and the volume of income, but they could also have the wherewithal, the means to hire lawyers, accountants, deferred income specialists, favor grabbers, lobbyists. They can hire politicians, for God's sakes, which is what they do. And you would do it too if you were in their shoes. That's what they can do. And that is what they do. And they use that. And it is amazing how effective they are at doing that.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Sure, so, please, fire away.
Because with the taxes, right, the redistribution of wealth, the transfer, what would you do to solve the tax issue right now? I mean, I know that you're a fan of the flat tax. Is that something that you?
That's what I do. Is I do just what I did with Jerry Brown when he ran for president. I was his economist. We get rid of all federal taxes, all of them, with the exception of sin taxes. And the reason that we don't want to get rid of sin taxes is because their purpose is not so much to raise revenues as to change behavior. I jokingly say we Americans don't like drunk people smoking while we shoot each other. But you know what I'm saying. Speeding tickets are not to get money so much as they are to stop speeders. You with me?
Absolutely.
Get rid of all. And by the way, sin tax are a very small proportion of total federal tax. I get rid of all other taxes, personal income tax, corporate tax, death tax, capital gains tax. I get rid of all excise taxes. I get rid of payroll taxes in both employer and employee, Medicare, Medicaid. I get rid of all excise tariffs. I get rid of all federal taxes except for the sin taxes and have two flat rate taxes, one on business net sales, which I call value added, and one on personal unadjusted gross income with no deductions, no exemptions, no exclusions on those two. If you did that, you can replace all federal taxes, all of them, with a tax of approximately 11.8% on each. Now, remember, no deductions, exemptions, no any of those. All right. Now, with Jerry Brown, I rounded it up to 12%. And when he got it, he rounded it up to 13%. To make sure this was without any Laffer curve effect, to make sure that there were no shortfalls in revenues. All right. That's the tax I would do as a low rate, broad based flat tax, inclusive of all federal taxes, with the exception of the sin tax. And that would just generate the most amazing machine growth of America. We would have so damn many jobs around. The poor would get rich. Everyone would have incomes higher, just like what happened under Trump. As you know, when Trump did the tax there and lowered the corporate from 35 to 21%, you saw what happened to poverty levels. You saw what happened to incomes. You saw what happened to at median incomes went way up there. They hadn't been up for 20 years. All of that happened. And that's what I do. And you'd create a chance for people to really get in. And you'd have more revenues for the federal government to help those who really can't help themselves. So I ask you the question, where is the bleeding heart liberal like me who really wants to help poor people, who wants to really help people who don't have a chance in this world? Where are they now? A low rate, broad based flat tax would give you the revenues to be able to make sure that no one fell through the trap and became destitute, walking on the streets, not making it. Where's your heart to be truly compassionate at? You have to be clear eyed. You have to look at facts, not pretend that facts exist that don't exist. And if you pretend that, you're going to deceive the people and cause the very destruction of prosperity that you're trying to avoid. And, you know, that's what these guys are doing. And it's a tragedy in the making. It's been what they've been doing forever. I am really a true liberal in the sense I really want to create economic growth. And I want to really create prosperity for the poor, the minority. That's why I wrote Enterprise Zones. The inner cities need to have tax cuts. Do you know how expensive it is being an inner city person on welfare, all of a sudden getting a job, how much income you lose because you lose your welfare? I wrote that for Reagan, and we tried to push through enterprise zones at that time. That was my baby as well as the tax cuts. This is what we should do. Okay, I've lectured you long enough.
You know what? Actually, I know you have a hard stop. I wish we had more time. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure, one more. Let's go.
All right. So the debt, the national debt, all the unfunded liabilities with the taxes, you know, that David Walker said, I think at one point, you know, all this debt is nothing more than deferred taxes, right? Because
That's what he said, yes.
Right?
It's not true. That's not true.
It's not true. Okay. So why is it not true and how do we resolve it?
Well, because with Reagan, this is the white paper by Alan Greenspan. But what we did is we raised the age of retirement from 65 to 67. We made half of the benefits taxable, and we changed a lot of the system there, and that reduced the unfunded liabilities that day. They were gone. We can do that with good legislation. You give me a big magnifying glass, you give me a sharp pencil, you let me go into these social programs with their unfunded liabilities, and I can change them and make them fully funded and correctly done right away. That's number one. Number two, let's talk about the debt that's paper debt, the actual deficit, the national debt. When you look at debt, I want to ask you a question. How much would you borrow if I would lend to you at 1% and let you invest guaranteed returns at 10%? How much should you borrow?
Everything I can.
Thank you. Reverse those two numbers. I'm going to let you borrow all you want at 10% unless you invest all you want at 1%. How much should you borrow?
Zero.
Yes. Borrowing is not the problem. Borrowing is a tool. The problem comes with the spread. Now, when we came in 1981 under the real president, Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. we had a government that had been run into the ground by the four previous left-wing socialists who'd run it back with taxes and all the social spending and all that nonsense there. We found the country in a big heap, a pile. We dug into that pile. We found this little brass sign, polished it up on our jacket and put it up there. It said Enterprise America USA. And we had this country that we borrowed lots and lots of money. And we used it to cut tax rates, to invest in the structure of the U.S. And we borrowed, and hopefully we thought we borrowed cheap and lent with high returns. And then we built up America. And then we sat back and prayed that we were correct on our analysis. And lo and behold, we got the boom of the century.
You tested your fitness level, not your workout routine. I'm talking about your financial endurance. Because if saving to a 401k is the extent of your effort, it is time for you to start shaping up. And Ed Sedell is here to help you do that with The Retirement Trainer. It's his podcast to help you examine your financial stamina and learn the questions you should be asking and areas to focus on to help you get to that place you've been working so hard for, a happy, comfortable retirement. And it's not as hard as some might have made you believe. Ed's broken it down into 5 simple steps. It's the retirement fitness plan, which he personally created to help clarify key areas of your financial life. Learn more about the retirement fitness plan at egsifinancial.com. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Investment advisory services offered through EGSI Investment Management, DBA EGSI Financial Group, a registered investment advisor. Insurance and annuities offered through EGSI Financial Services, Inc., Ohio License Number 102-06-19.